Welcome to The Gathering Resources. The following audio is from our breakout session entitled Sexual Abuse, How Leaders Prevent Abuse, Love Survivors, and Act with Integrity. This session is moderated by Christy Singleton and features Rachel Denhollander, Rachel Gill, and Samantha Kilpatrick.
All right, everybody. I know you're warm out there. We're facing the right way, I guess. Thank you so much for coming to this breakout session. My name is Christy Singleton. I'm a gathering participant. My husband runs our family foundation. I know some of you. And I'm just really honored to be here. I also have a vocational passion and lifelong work in working with caring for victims of abuse. And so this is honestly such an honor to be able to lead this breakout session. So I'm just going to sort of briefly introduce them, and then they're going to get started, and then we're going to take some questions. So the issue of sexual abuse spans across so many areas that there's no way we're going to talk about them all today, but we are going to consider a few. As leaders of organizations and on boards, what does it look like to put the person before the institution? How do we do that well? What's proper care for victims? What about prevention and policies? How do we do that? Where do we go to find that out if we're interested in doing a better job? And also, just to touch on this issue within the evangelical church, especially for domestic violence victims, where we have for so many years put marriage as an institution above people, and people are getting hurt because we value that more than we value people. And so we're going to touch on that as well. We got like 20 minutes, so we're not gonna land any planes. We're just gonna kind of hover around. But I think everybody here obviously might stay a little bit after. There's contact information if you want to talk about them after. But the big thing is that how can we as Christians respond like Christ would in this situation and in these instances that we all hear about, we all know about, and how can we do a better job, not even a better job, but a job that's redemptive. And I think all of us that come to the gathering are really focused on that. And so I'm excited that you guys are here. Rachel Denhollander is going to get us started. Then she'll introduce Rachel Gill, who will talk a little bit about victim care and church dynamics. And then Samantha Kilpatrick will talk a bit about policy and the legal aspects. And then I'll come back on when I'm waved at for a Q&A at the end. So thank you very much for being here.
Awesome. Thank you very much. I'm really excited for this segment to really get into the nuts and bolts. I'm going to try to go pretty quickly here and just give you guys a bird's eye overview and then turn it over to Rachel to talk about the practical aspects of victim care and Samantha, the policy. But what I want to emphasize first and foremost is just the incredible power that you have individually in your communities and in your organizations to really lead the way in both care and response. And there are two dynamics we're going to look at very briefly. We're going to look at external focus and then internal health. So external focus is, how do I, with the resources that God has given me, how do I reach out to those who have harmed? What does it look like to come alongside survivors? And we're going to broaden this discussion to include survivors of domestic violence, because the reality is that so much of sexual violence happens in a family capacity. And for many women who have experienced domestic violence, a lot of the dynamics that we talked about in the plenary session are really equally true for them as well. So external focus. What I hope one of the takeaways was from our previous session is that life is radically different for a survivor of sexual or domestic violence. And most of the time, the types of healing and support that they need are just practically beyond their reach. Cutting-edge medical treatments and trauma therapy, neural reprocessing, those are all incredibly expensive treatments that most survivors don't have access to. Most of them can't carry the weight or don't have the family support to even get a college education or finish high school. So many survivors or women in crisis situations are left in this vicious cycle where they're barely surviving on a minimum wage job. They can't pay for therapy or anything to help them be able to sustain a higher stress load. They have no resources for further education or job training. And what ultimately ends up happening to so many of them is that they continue in this cycle of just barely making it by. They never get the help they need to be able to thrive or flourish. And then the chronic medical conditions and the PTSD and the mental health conditions they're suffering under eventually reach a critical point to where they become legally incapacitated. And then they have no choice but to live the rest of their life on Section 8 housing and food stamps, because practical help and care to heal these wounds is just completely out of reach. And it's a very similar story for women escaping domestic violence. Most of these women don't have a job resume or job history to allow them to be able to provide a house for their children. They don't have the retainer for the attorney to be able to fight a custody battle to keep their child safe from an abuser. They don't have their own credit history. They don't have access to their bank account. And so they can't even get an apartment without a co-signer, even if they could get a job to afford one. So we have this situation where we need to be asking from an external perspective, how do we steward the resources, the time, the money, or platforms that God has given us to be able to come alongside ministries that are the boots on the ground for these survivors and women, and also to be able to educate and train our communities. Now, some people that I work with have opted to sponsor conferences for their churches so that they can equip their churches for how to understand and respond to abuse better, or sponsor education conferences for their communities at large to start shaping a culture in their community that understands how to identify abusive patterns and then how to respond well to them. So asking that question from an external perspective. But then you also have incredible power from an internal perspective. And when I say internal, I'm meaning the health of your organization. If any of you are familiar with the Ravi Zacharias scandal, something that we have seen very clearly is that this can happen in your nonprofit. It can happen in your corporation. Mercy Corps is undergoing the same type of process right now. And ultimately, what often ends up happening is a trail of survivors are left devastated in the wake. And then also, the goals and the good things that you wanted to accomplish with the ministry wind up damaged in the process, too. So often, our nonprofits and ministries are started up at the beginning with a passion for doing something very good. But in the effort of getting started up, most of the time, we don't necessarily have that look-back process of how do we structure our organization well to catch abuse? What are our human resources policies going to look like? How are we selecting our boards? What are the checks and balances in power? Do we have communication silos? And oftentimes in Christian organizations, we actually have theological hangups. We have, most of the time when I come in and I work with Christian institutions and Christian boards, there's a theological reason why they don't have good human resources policies. We have misunderstandings of our concepts of justice and forgiveness that lead us to have very lax policy and structure, or to not prioritize or not be able to identify abusive patterns well. And so looking at how you can train and educate your organization first to have the right heart understanding of abuse and abusive dynamics, the right heart motivation, but then also how you set your organization up from a structural perspective to be well equipped to identify and handle patterns of abuse or harassment that may arise, and also to have a very morally centered crisis response. This goes into how you interact with your Office of General Counsel, the attorneys that you're getting counsel from. Anybody who works in the advocacy realm will tell you that most of the time when we come in and we're cleaning up situations, a lot of the issues have actually been caused by the corporate attorneys. Because attorneys are trained to think in terms of fiduciary concepts, and our law school training is very myopic. It looks at upfront costs instead of long-term damage. And oftentimes this means that your boards, your administration, your attorneys are going to be just thinking about liability and not thinking, A, about just the practical reality that when you don't do the right thing, you often cost your ministry more in the long run. And you often cause more intangible damage to your reputation, your donor base, and the very goals that you espouse and the theology you espouse because you didn't do the right thing. But then also, you've left a trail of survivors in your wake. You haven't asked the moral questions. And so what we want to do at this in this segment with the remainder of the time is have Rachel talk about the external focus, because she works with a ministry that does a phenomenal job, give her wings, being boots on the ground for the mamas who are leaving domestic violence, and do the training and education. And then Samantha, who's an attorney who works with corporations, talk about this institutional dynamic.
All right, thank you, Rachel. I want to tell you a story. It's a true story. Two women from the same church each lost their husband in the same week. The first was a homeschooling mom. Her husband was the breadwinner. When it happened, the church immediately started making phone calls, sending emails, trying to get everybody on board, getting everybody ready to jump in. Those who were gifted in administration jumped in to form teams. Within days, they had a child care team, a yard care team, clothing for the kids team, car repair team, home repair team, meal team, even an encouragement team of people just focused on being one-on-one with her during the day. They also had a fundraising team, and in just a few days, they raised a full year of living expenses for the family. It was incredible. It was incredible coming together. Everyone pitched in. The second woman was also a homeschooling mom in a very similar situation, very similar set of needs. But when the church leaders found out about the loss of her husband, they didn't pick up the phone or send an email. They told her, for the sake of the gospel, we don't want you to tell anyone in the church about this. You're focused too much on your own perceived needs and not enough on the state of your soul, your relationship with God. We can't help you. That second woman lost her home. She and her kids went into deep poverty and years of additional hardship that could have been avoided had the church leaders seen her widowhood as worthy of help. And you probably know where I'm going with this. What was the difference between the two women? The first woman's husband died in a car accident. The second woman's husband was abusing her and the kids. So what was it that opened the doors to help for the first woman and slammed the doors shut for the second? It was the number one most important thing that you as a leader bring to the table. And it actually has nothing to do with money. It's totally free. As leaders, the number one thing you can do to help domestic abuse survivors in your midst is to recognize them as worthy of help and to say so. Because everyone is looking to you as the leader to give the word. They're waiting for your blessing to jump into action. They're waiting for your permission because they trust you. You're the one who gives them the green light. They're ready to share, ready to give, ready to organize, but they're waiting for the word. But why don't we give that word? So often it's because of theological walls. When we hear about someone who was sexually abused out there in the world, someone she wasn't related to, someone she never saw again, it's really easy for us to say, that is clearly wrong. That demands justice. We stand against that. We'll do whatever it takes. But when the abuse is within the family, suddenly all our theological walls go up. Wait, God hates divorce. Children, honor your parents. God wants intact families. Don't you know the statistics about broken homes? All things are possible. Submit more. Try harder. Die to yourself more. You'll ruin our witness for Christ. Can't this be resolved through Matthew 18? What about not suing fellow Christians? What's clear in other situations out there, and what's even a crime in other situations out there, suddenly becomes a family matter to us because of theological confusion. And we get paralyzed and the woman gets no help. But if we can wrestle through those barriers and tell our people that this is legit ministry, we unlock the door to a community of help beyond even what we can offer personally. That's just waiting to be unleashed. And a side note, if you'd like to wrestle through the theology, I highly recommend books by Leslie Vernick, Natalie Hoffman, Darby Strickland, and Sheila Gregor. But beyond telling people that this is legit, we also need to understand the context that we're inviting them into. Because with domestic abuse, it's not just an isolated act, it's part of an overall system of power and control that this woman is living in. She's locked out of the bank accounts, which might only be in his name. She gets an allowance for groceries, maybe. Maybe she's not allowed to have a credit card. Maybe she never got to go to college or was never allowed to work and has no recent work experience. If she leaves, she's penniless. He monitors her phone, her email, her location. She's isolated from family and friends. Maybe he even moved her away in a speedy engagement so she'd have nowhere to turn. He becomes friends with the spiritual leaders in her life so they'll never believe her if she goes for help. And on the couch at night, he uses Bible verses to tell her that God gives him the right to do these things. She'll get in trouble if she tells anyone. So given this system that she's in, there are several main ways we can help. Financial resources, in-person support, and education. So let's start with financial. Housing. Does your church or ministry own houses, apartments, empty parsonages, mission houses, Airbnbs, somewhere she could stay temporarily for very low cost or free while she considers next steps? Trauma therapy. At this point, she may have developed PTSD, a physical brain injury from trauma that can cause difficulty functioning every day. And right now, she needs full access to her mental resources more than ever. but therapy is expensive and often doesn't go through insurance. What would it look like to develop a counseling fund? A retainer for an attorney. She'll probably need one for the long road ahead, and often abusers use the legal system to continue re-traumatizing their victims and draining them of financial resources. Jobs. What business owners are in your network who could possibly provide flexible hours or even remote work so she can be accessible to her kids? Turn my page here. Day-to-day needs. Meals, gas cards, car repairs, clothing. Basically, if her husband actually did die in a car accident, what would she need? Does your church organization have a benevolence fund? Is it set up to provide help for those in crisis? And now in terms of in-person support, companioning, childcare, a team of people to babysit or have the kids over occasionally, to be on call, to become emergency contacts, and companions, people to sit with and help her make that difficult call to the authorities, to go with her to the courthouse, to take notes when she meets with an attorney, to help her map out her options in a notebook, to pray with her, to give her a place to celebrate holidays, to have dinner together, to meet her at the park with the kids. And finally, educating yourself on what's available around you. Are you connected to your local domestic violence center, your local child advocacy center? The experts there will be able to provide her with legal guidance alongside your support. And with one in four women being victims of domestic violence, what might it look like to have some of your people get some training in abuse dynamics? You being able to offer resources and companionship built on an understanding of these dynamics can be the difference between a victim staying and leaving, surviving and not surviving. In my work at Give Her Wings, we provide financial aid and community to women who've each lost their Christian community for leaving an abusive marriage. And for each, it's basically this same story. Not being considered worthy of help by the Christian community led to not receiving any help, which led to deeper poverty and isolation, which led to deeper trauma for the mother, which led to deeper trauma for the children, and effects that may ripple for generations. But we have the opportunity to change course. By believing that spiritual widows and orphans are worthy of our help, and having the systems of help already ready in place, we can keep deeper trauma and poverty from setting in. And that opens the door to healing for both mothers and children for generations to come. Thank you.
Thank you, Rachel. My name is Samantha Kilpatrick. I'm from Raleigh, North Carolina, where I practice law. Primarily, my work is in the abuse space. I both represent survivors of abuse and helping them figure out what their legal path may not be, and trying to figure out what options they want to take in that regard. And I also represent faith-based organizations from a prevention and protection side, as well as a response and reporting side. And so thank you so much for having us. Thank you to the gathering for prioritizing this topic. I want to speak today and just challenge you as leaders in your communities, whether it be leaders on boards, leaders in corporations, leaders in faith-based organizations such as Christian schools and other child-serving organizations. I want to challenge you to think about what you can do to be an influence in changing culture in these organizations, because what we need is change of culture. As Rachel Denhollander spoke, a lot of times where we see this go wrong, and where we see the most harm is the actual response of organizations. And so we have to ask ourselves, are we willing to put an organization over an individual? And I think that's where we come down to the fact that this is actually a gospel issue. We have to look at what Jesus did. How did Jesus treat those who were vulnerable, those who were hurt, those who were marginalized? Did he put the organization and the systems above the care of those organizations? I mean, above those survivors and individuals, and he did not. And so that's where I want to focus our time, but focus our time specifically from a legal perspective. I think our first speaker, the first plenary speaker today, gave us a great metaphor I think what he said is, in Western culture, we like to use the super glue like it never happened and to kind of brush over it.
Whereas what he was talking about is kind of working within that brokenness and working there in a way to where growth is produced. And I think that applies very, very pointedly to this space. What we see a lot of times in organizations is we see a desire to silence, a desire to kind of hold things very much internally, and that creates more pain, more hurt, more vulnerability. In my experience, survivors who come forward in an organization, especially in faith-based organizations, they are coming to their church and their spiritual leaders because they believe that those people can help them in the crisis that they are in. That's why they come. The reason that those situations turn in a different way is because of the response of those organizations. So I want you guys to really think about and be challenged by how do we respond well in those situations. Where I get involved is I work on a survivor side and I work on an organization side. And today, in just working from an organizational side, I want to kind of talk through just some things that you might consider in your organizations, in your churches, in your Christian schools, as far as legal advice goes in regard to this topic. There are two main categories in this topic. One is prevention and protection, which is on the offensive side, or it's the side where we're going to do everything we can to prevent and protect from abuse happening in our communities. The other side is the response. So when, not if, but when there is a crisis in your community, how are we going to respond and how are we going to respond well? So in looking at that prevention and protection side, I would urge you to think about the organizations that you serve, the organizational communities that you're involved with. Ask questions about what does their policy look like? But not only what does their policy look like, what are their values and what are they prioritizing? Oftentimes I will go into churches and organizations and in their trainings, they're talking about how they're doing this training in order to protect the church or to protect the school. That's a red flag right there, because what we want is we want a culture that the reason that we jump through these hoops in this policy is because we're trying to protect children. We're trying to protect the vulnerable. And it is worth going that extra mile and going to those extra steps to have another adult present, to follow the rules in this way, to be in an open space, and all of those things. It is worth it because we want to protect children and we want to protect the vulnerable. And so that is one thing that we need to look at is what are we prioritizing and what are we valuing in our communities? And then do our policies come out of that? And even the way that we train, does that come out of those priorities and those values? In turning to response, I just want to talk briefly about response. A lot of times that's where the attorneys come in. And in that space, what you want to be looking for in an attorney that advises your organization is, like Rachel said, in law school, we are trained on liability and we're trained on protecting the organization or protecting the organization or the individual that we represent. So it's very, very myopic. What you want to find in an attorney, if you can find it, is you want to find an attorney who is trauma-informed, who is also spiritually informed and understands the theology that you're coming from and understands how that works and doesn't only advise you on legal issues, but advises you on legal issues in regard to your spiritual beliefs and your theological beliefs and morals as well. So a lot of times I find myself advising clients and they want to know about liability. And I'm like, these are the options and these are the paths. A lot of times in reporting statutes, you might find that somebody might not be legally obligated to report, but my next thought to that client is, what should we do morally? What would Jesus want us to do? And so those are the things that I want you guys to think about. So in response, I'm going to hurry up because my time is almost out, but get help early and soon. Build community resources and know who your helpers are before you find yourself in crisis. Communicate well and communicate with a very survivor-centric focus. Also report, over-report, always fall on the side of reporting. Educate and be the example in your community for how to handle this well and how to love survivors well. And just think about your fiduciary duty is not about the money and the liability. It's about doing the right thing and doing the right thing for those who have come to you because they trust you and they need help and support. Thank you.
All right, we're going to go ahead and take some questions. Just a couple things, just knowing the stats. A lot of us probably have personal experience with this. And so because of just obviously the space here, just maybe keep the questions a little less personal. But you have something you want to talk about personally, I'm sure any one of us would love to talk to you about it afterwards. But you're going to go ahead and raise your hand if you have a question, and we'll just take it from there. And if you have somebody particularly you want to ask it to, you can just address that question. All right, Amy up here. If you want to say it, I can say it back to everybody else. Okay, great. Then you take it away.
My question is really, okay, yeah, plan ahead, you know, set your policies in place, or then you gotta basically, you gotta deal with the crisis. So my question is, when you're dealing with that in an organization, how do you handle when some of the people are not bored?
You know, great question. I don't know if you guys could hear that in the back, but basically, I didn't think so. she's asking about basically the split that happens a lot. You've got some people who are really interested in what's right, in my opinion, and should be right, in everybody's opinion, and also protecting the institution. And how do you navigate that? Maybe some tools for that. So I don't know who wants, y'all all probably could talk an hour on that.
That's almost always the situation in my experience. Most of the time when I come in and I'm consulting with organizations, I'm coming in to basically bring everybody together. Hey, I'm going to talk to your attorney and we're going to start speaking the same language. I'm going to explain to you the liability concerns that he has, and then we're going to talk about the trauma and the ethical concerns. I'm going to come in and help you get the right organization in place to do the backwards-looking assessment and the forwards-looking. So I'm coming in and I'm kind of taking a multifaceted approach. I almost never have everybody on the same team. You know, most of the time, most of the problems are with the boards. You know, either the board is holding things up or the administration is. They're both fighting heads and butting each other. You know, the ideal, of course, is that you work together to be able to get on the same page. You do what you can from an education and training standpoint and a moral standpoint to say, look, this is what we really need to do and here's why. And you are wise as a serpent and gentle as a dove. You speak their language. Sometimes when I come in, I talk to boards about the financial aspect. If you don't do the right thing, this is what's going to happen to you financially. You're going to lose your donor base. You're going to lose you're going to lose the trust. You're going to wind up paying more in fees. That's not what should motivate them, but sometimes that's what is. And so you talk about the moral questions, but you also try to get them on board for whatever their mindset is. Wise as a serpent and gentle as a dove. At the same time, you also have to realize that you've got a very, very limited window to do the right thing before you have created a spiral that you can't get out of anymore. And so when I'm working with the ones who want to do the right thing, my counsel to them is you've got to put the decision back in the board's lap. You can't, or whoever the bad actors are, you've got to put it back in their lap. You cannot allow them to keep controlling the narrative. And you do need to realize when you've gotten to a point that you have to speak publicly. And you have to put the spotlight and the responsibility for why the right things aren't happening on the people that are holding that up. Because if you don't do that, what it communicates to the victims is nobody cares, nobody's fighting for me. It communicates to your donor base and the community around you, nobody cares, nobody's going to do the right thing. And I do think that window is very, very small. And how that is done is usually, you know, if you're a publicly held organization, how that's done is usually with regular updates. So you can do very simple things like, we presented the board with the compensation plan for survivors on this date. As of this date, they have not voted on it yet. We asked the board to take these steps. As of this date, they have not voted on that yet. And you're being very gracious. You're giving the bad actors a chance to do the right thing. But you're highlighting, A, what needs to be done, and you're taking that opportunity to educate the community around you. Here's what we need to do, and here's why. Here's what we've asked for, and this hasn't been done yet. That helps put the external pressure on the bad actors to do the right thing, and hopefully you get there. But at bare minimum, you're educating the community around you. You're making it clear what needs to be done, and you're putting the pressure where it needs to go.
I would just reiterate what Rachel is saying. Bringing someone in as a consultant to kind of try to bring things together, but you've got to be very proactive about doing that, because these situations can turn very quickly. They can turn in one meeting. I saw one last week happen. The first meeting with a survivor went really well. 6 days later, the survivor meets with a pastor again, and everything kind of turns. And so it happens quickly, and so you've got to kind of be aware of what's going on, what the narrative is that's coming out, and know when you need to communicate, like, what's happening, and push that board or push that organization to begin to do things. But outside experts are very helpful in that.
And knowing who has the authority mm-hmm. to do what, having those checks and balances built in place. So with the RZM, just as an example, I was brought in as a consultant, but I was hired by administration because the board didn't want to touch me. So having that check and balance where the administration had at least some leeway to do the right things was really helpful, because we could at least get some good things done, even though the board was holding it up. Knowing that you're the one who's in charge, this is a mistake I see all the time, is if you have an Office of General Counsel that's giving you bad legal advice, and this is why having a trauma-informed consultant is very helpful, to be able to say, hey, that's not normal. This actually is not okay. To know that you're the one in charge and that you are not bound by what your attorney says you have to do. What I hear so often is, well, we can't do that. Our attorney says we can't. Like, no. Nobody's going to jail if you tell the truth. You can do that. Your attorney just doesn't want you to, and these are the dynamics that they're looking at. I had a church recently that countersued a sexual assault survivor for court costs and damages. I said, what in the world are you doing? Well, our attorney said that's a boilerplate provision. Yeah, in a car accident, maybe. Not in a child sex abuse case. Well, our attorney said to put it in. Okay, but you're the one in charge. And the most successful crisis response is either when you have a very good attorney, which is frankly very hard to find, or you have a board or an administration that says, this is the direction we're headed. We understand the liability concerns. We thank you for your counsel. We're going to do this as wisely as possible. But you are our attorney, and we're asking you to clean it up this way. Know what your authority is. You're not at the beck and call of the attorney.
My husband is an attorney, but I always tell people, they work for you. You don't
right.
work for them. And so you can tell them what you want to do and have them help you do that the best way possible.
Exactly. And ask the hard questions of them. If it doesn't feel right, if it doesn't feel like it's survivor-centric and taking into account the harm and the suffering that's going on, ask those hard questions. Push. Talk to them about your theology and the way that you want this to go. Because you hired them.
I think you were next.
I'm wondering if you heard of the law change in Minnesota that happened this week. There was a female lawyer that got the law changed so that there is now no ending or
statute of limitations.
Pardon?
Statute of limitations.
Yes, statute of limitations. And also, it's in the favor if the young woman who was raped, if she happened to be drinking, she now has rights.
Mm-hmm.
They can defend her. I don't know if you've heard of that law change in Minnesota, and I don't know if it's any place else, but it's giving more help to the victim,
yep.
who is totally discounted most of the time. And also in your work, and this is going to sound terrible, is it a gender thing? Men just don't want to change their minds about the fact that it's the woman's fault. She shouldn't have worn those clothes.
Yes and no, it's a gender thing. Yes, there is a definite gender dynamic. I think it has a lot to do with our porn culture. When you have conditioned yourself societally to look at women as sex objects, it shouldn't be that much of a surprise to us that they begin to be treated like them, or that we're not that disturbed when they are. And Rachel mentioned a book by Sheila Grigori that actually looks at what I call evangelical porn culture. This theological idea that women are either a threat to a godly man, or they're the means to an end, the means to children, the means to sexual fulfillment. Our Christian theology on sexuality really mirrors porn culture. because it looks at women as means to a sexual end or temptation. They're seen first and foremost in their identity as a sexual being. And when you have created a theological system that views women as a means to an end or temptation, you have mimicked the porn mindset, and you've put a scriptural layer over the top of it. And so again, it doesn't seem like that big of a deal when a woman is taken advantage of sexually, or it doesn't raise the alarm bells like it should. So I do think we have a lot of mental retraining that needs to be done.
And unfortunately in the Christian community.
Unfortunately very much in the Christian community.
And we're very excited about the law changes like that. We just recently had something similar to that in North Carolina. I had a case a number of years ago where the prosecutor wouldn't take it because of the intoxication piece, and it was just so frustrating and so so harmful to survivors that was the case. And so very thankful that those things are happening.
Yeah, absolutely. I know I'm not really the expert, but I do have to say I think it's also a female issue because females are conditioned in that way as well.
Oh, sure.
And I have been so surprised when I brought things up, and I've been the most angry responses are from women, because that's just not right.
Yeah,
because they have, it's a everybody issue.
Well, and another point, I volunteered at a women's prison in Minnesota for a while, and the women who are arrested and come, I learned that a high percentage of them were abused. They're told they're ugly.
Right.
They're told they're not worth anything.
Right.
And so how do you have to help them realize that God loves them, are worthy, but it's a really huge blockage to get over the women's mindset of I'm totally worthless.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see. I don't know. Oh, we don't have a mic, so I'm just calling on you.
Yes.
And I repeat it, nobody can hear it.
Kind of to echo her question around ounce of prevention, I'm guessing that on the panel you could like lead us to best practices in terms of policies and kind of how to have these things in place. What would be the best resource to identify that and access that?
He's asking about the best resource to get the policies right.
Yeah, there is a manual out there written by Boz Chavidian about safeguarding policies.
Safeguarding. I think it's safeguarding policies.
Safeguarding
in your
policies
churches.
And procedures in churches. Is a good starting place. You want to make sure that you are looking kind of at everything from hiring and employment application, background checks. And background checks are just something that you need to do. They're not necessarily proving a whole lot of stuff because a lot of times, somebody has just not been caught yet. So that's not something that you can kind of rely on. But you're going to want to look at employment, volunteer interviews and application and questions, good questions with that, and then putting policies in place, but then also putting response to policies in place where you even have minor violations of what do? We retrain, we observe, we watch, and we do things, and also have a clear reporting system to where people can have a place where they can actually go and feel comfortable about reporting their concerns about things that they're seeing, where that's actually received well rather than somebody seen as a troublemaker or somebody just upset. So we want to change that culture of making our organizations trustworthy and transparent so people feel comfortable coming to share.
And I would absolutely piggyback on that. I love Boz's work. His ministry, Grace, does a lot of training for churches. I think that's the best training for churches because it really comes from a morally and spiritually centered dynamic of how do we get to the heart of abuse. Knowing what your crisis response is going to be and making that clear to your church. If you receive an allegation of abuse against an authority figure and you haven't communicated to your church, your organization, hey, when this happens, this is what we're going to do. We are going to file a police report. We are going to announce it publicly to the congregation, and we're going to give enough information where anybody who might hold a piece of the puzzle knows where to go to report. Intrinsically, oftentimes, especially as Christians, say, well, what about due process? Well, what about false allegations? But the reality is, if that's your policy, this is what we do every time we receive an allegation, especially against a leader or somebody in authority, what you're doing is putting yourself not in the position of deciding what's true and what's not. You're simply opening up the way for evidence to come forward. And when you don't do that, especially in cases of child abuse, pattern evidence is usually the best evidence that we have. Any kind of predatory behavior, pattern evidence is usually the best that we've got. So if you don't announce those allegations publicly and just have that standard in place, that process in place, what you've really done is shut down the chain of evidence, because nobody who holds a piece of the puzzle is going to know that they hold it and know what to do with it. So the way you communicate to your organizations is incredibly important, because survivors are always looking to see, where am I safe to come forward? If they hear you teaching on domestic violence and sexual abuse, if they hear correct theology on divorce and and these dynamics that we're talking about, when they hear you message that, what it tells them is, these people are going to understand. This is a safe place to speak up. That's your best bet at catching a bad actor in your midst. And then it's also your greatest deterrent to somebody who is a bad actor. Bad actors and predators are very skilled manipulators. They don't want to be where they can't manipulate. If they know they can't manipulate you because of how you're messaging on domestic violence and sexual violence, they're not going to hang around. So your best deterrent is how you message and communicate. And especially if you're dealing with a very large church or with a corporation, I would add on to your child abuse policy that you need to be looking at things that aren't necessarily directly related to abuse. You need to be looking at, do we understand power dynamics? Is our staff, our employees, do they understand power dynamics so that they can catch where things are not right? Do we have communication silos in our organization? Do we have proper checks and balances on our boards? Do we have good accountability mechanisms? There's a lot of how we structure our corporations that have a very direct impact on whether or not you're going to catch a bad actor in your midst. If your corporation is not structured well, your nonprofit is not structured well, you're not going to have the tools. And so we need to look first and foremost at child protection policies and our human resources, the things we automatically think of when we think of abuse and harassment. But then we've got to look at the broader culture of our organization and the broader structure of our organization, because that really has the biggest impact.
All right, I think we have time for maybe one more question. Trisha?
Yeah, I was wondering, when you're in that middle part, maybe the board and the administration, someone's coming forward and there is not agreement on how to proceed, how do you avoid re-traumatizing the process?
She's asking, when you're in the middle part where something has happened or been reported, and how do we not re-traumatize the person while you have half the people not believing or not wanting to take action and other people doing the right thing?
I think there's a couple layers to that, and I know Samantha and Rachel can speak to this too. But I think that's why it's very important, A, to have the right processes in place so that you have the tools to be able to support the survivor and at least communicate what should be done. If you have the ability for certain people in your organization, say it's the board, the administration fighting, but if the administration has the ability to put out updates and to communicate with the survivor within the scope of how you've structured your organization, this is what we think we need to be done, this is what we're fighting for. And then you're messaging that publicly. This is what needs to be done, this is what we've asked. Then the survivor at least knows that they're not betrayed by everybody. And giving them a return to some level of agency and choice. So when I come in and I work with organizations, one of the ways that we set it up is that I'm able to speak with the survivors and I'm able to give them updates. And I give them updates before something comes out publicly. So I say, hey, we've got a press release coming out. This is what it's going to say. I wanted to let you know ahead of time so you're not surprised in the morning. It helps give them agency. It helps return dignity to them. And it helps let them know that at least there are some individuals who are fighting for them and who are going to message very clearly that they're fighting for them. And sometimes that's the best you can do. But if you can at least do that much, it helps.
I think in some situations I've seen organizations who have, and like I said, they've set stuff up, like Rachel's talking about, ahead of time of how they're going to work through these issues. But setting up where they have almost advocates within the organization to walk alongside and do some of that communication, do some of that care. Also doing the groundwork beforehand to know what support services you have in your community, whether it be a child advocacy center, a women's crisis center, or other, friendly therapists that people know and feel really good about in the trauma space, that you can try to help that person get the support that they need, but also making sure that you're not pushing support, that they've got to have the agency to be able to kind of forge their path. So the more that we give them a voice back, I think that really helps in the healing thing, but not communicating in a way to where survivors are not surprised, I have found, is huge for them.